We have been setting up Leviticus 11 to 15 that sets forth the distinctions between clean and unclean. And what we said thus far is that clean and unclean are not moral categories. Now, they are related to moral categories in that both sin and impurity things need to be taken away and are removed by the Day of Atonement. But these refer more to the status and condition of a person than they do their moral integrity. And what we mean by that is, being unclean didn't mean that you were sinful or necessarily that you had done something wrong. Now, that you may do something wrong that makes you unclean, but many times just natural course of life might render a person unclean. Conversely, just because you were holy like a priest doesn't mean that you were necessarily a good person, okay? Clean and unclean and holiness all have to do with access to God. And there are basically two ritual states. There's holy, which is like the priests who are dedicated to the Lord and have greater access to Him. And then there's common, which is divided into the categories of clean and unclean. The normal state of an Israelite is clean, okay? God made Israel clean, separate from the nations, when He delivered Israel from Egypt through blood and water. Okay, God, through the blood of Passover and through the baptism in the Red Sea, Israel became God's clean people. And the nations, by contrast, were left in their uncleanness. Okay, so now God's going to take up residence among Israel, and now Israel, because of their clean status, is going to be allowed to draw near. Now, if they incur some sort of uncleanness, that simply prohibits them from drawing near. In most cases, this would only last until sundown, and wouldn't even be an issue unless you were going to the tabernacle. All right? More major forms of uncleanness would require you to go to the priest, perhaps, and be sprinkled on the third day and on the seventh day, and so that you would become ceremonially clean on the eighth day or the day of new beginning. All right? Ordinarily, you just baptize yourself. You just cleanse yourself. And but in more major impurities, you have to go to the priest, which is, by the way, when you come to the New Testament and John the Baptist is out in the wilderness calling people to baptize, I mean, that would have got people's attention. Why do we have to go to him to be cleansed? Ordinarily, you just cleanse yourself. And see, John is basically saying you are an unclean people. You have contracted more major impurities, and that's why you have to be baptized by me, a priest. Okay? Just the fact that somebody else was calling you to do that would have gotten some attention. Okay? So, just remind you of those things. And finally, last week when we left off, we said that uncleanness, so cleanness gives you access to God. Uncleanness prohibits you from coming, drawing near to God. And so one of the things that characterizes uncleanness, it seems to be death and the curse. Okay? There's an association. To be clean is to be in a state of life or wholeness. To be unclean is to be symbolically dead. That's why you have to be baptized. You have to be cleansed in order to be brought back to life. Okay? You got to be born again, you know, of the water and spirit, you know, to use Jesus' language. If you look at the cleansing of Israel through Passover and through the Red Sea, and you associate that with the cleansing of a leper, with blood and water and a sprinkling of hyssop, it's very clear that Israel was born again at the Red Sea. And so when a leper was cleansed with blood and water, he was being born again, so to speak. Okay? He was being resurrected from the dead. We'll explain more of that We'll explain more of that later. But what I want us to see to start with is clean has to do with life and wholeness, and uncleanness has to do with death and the curse. Okay? With that in mind, I want to give a general overview of Leviticus 11 to 15 today, which makes distinctions between clean and unclean. And there's going to be, you know, we're not going to get into all these details. We would be here to the, you know, end of the year if we wanted to kind of look at every detail. And I don't want to do that with Leviticus, but I do want us to have a general overview. And what I want us to see is when you come to Leviticus 11 to 15, it's the flesh that's the source of uncleanness. Okay? And the flesh, you know, when you come to Paul and he talks all about the flesh, I mean, this is what it's rooted in, okay? The purity regulations are thus linked with the removal of flesh and circumcision. Circumcision renders one clean, but after a person becomes clean, they can become defiled again, and so they have to be cleansed. And so there seems to be a connection with man's fallen nature. His inability to save himself, his need to trust God for his salvation, that explains why there is a cutting off of the flesh at the male organ of procreation. Okay, God is going to have to produce the promised seed who is going to redeem mankind. When it comes to this literature, when it comes to the particulars, there's all sorts of disagreement. A lot more work needs to be done here. But most scholars believe that clearly that cleanness has to do with life, access to God, who is the source of life. Uncleanness has to do with death and the curse. I'm going to be following today the work of Jim Jordan on this area because I think he has delved into it and explained it to a little greater degree than most have. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people haven't read Jordan. He's not published like Gordon Wenham is or something. His, you know, commentary on Leviticus is very, very good. And so there's not as much interaction on with what Jordan has done. Now that Peter Lighthart is, I mean, everybody in intellectual circles is reading him, my hope is that others will interact with Jordan. But the Central School of Religion in London, England, they granted Jordan a doctorate on his work on this section of Leviticus. And it's just, there hasn't been enough, like, interaction with it, but it makes sense to me. Okay? What I mean is this. I get letter A here. There's a little part in quotes at the bottom says, "The curse of Eden is the curse of death, but that curse takes specific forms. Adam is cursed in his work, even her childbearing, the serpent, by being forced to go on the ground." Okay? What I'm going to suggest today, as we look at uncleanness, as everyone agrees, it's associated with death and it's associated with the curse. But what I want to do is link it specifically with the curse God pronounced on the serpent, Eve, Adam, etc., in the Garden of Eden. I think that's the key to really get at this legislation. Okay? I'll just go down to letter C here. It says, put all together. What this means is that uncleanness has to do with the judgments passed by God in Genesis 3. This explains why many of the cleansing rituals involve washing, because washing removes dirt and the curse on the soul towards man. It also explains why even something good and proper like childbirth results in uncleanness, and why animals that are serpent-like in their behavior might also be considered unclean. As such, uncleanness can be seen as a display of God's judgment for original sin. Okay? To illustrate, look over here on the board.
We're going to see, as we go through these chapters, Genesis 11 has to do with clean and unclean animals. And we'll see the unclean animals are the ones that specifically come into contact with death or with the soil, which is cursed towards man to break forth the corners of business. Alright? After that, okay, so if you think back to the garden, what does God do? He comes to the garden, and first he pronounces judgment.
Behind the legislation, Michael Morales says this in letter D. To summarize, while in Leviticus 11 to 15, uncleanness is not flatly or immediately equated with particular sinful acts, it is nevertheless treated as being generally or ultimately the result of sin. In other words, uncleanness represents the pollution of sin. Physical imperfection, disruptions, deformities, and maladies, though not considered sinful in themselves, nevertheless still reflect sin's damage and pollution of the earth and therefore require ritual cleansing. Okay? When man sinned, he brought judgment upon himself. And that judgment excludes him from God's presence. And so not only does the guilt of sin have to be dealt with, but the effects of sin have to be dealt with. And so the purity-impurity laws, the clean-unclean laws, seem especially to have to do with the effects of sin and the curse and the judgment upon man. Okay? These are all the things that would exclude someone from the presence of God. So that's why these things have to be cleansed in order to allow access. Does that kind of make sense? Any questions or comments right there? Okay, well, let's look at Roman numeral 2. Okay, we just said here, if you look in Genesis 3, God comes to the garden, and Adam and Eve are hiding. And, you know, God calls out to them, and, you know, why are you hiding, and et cetera. They tell him why, and they were naked, and who told you you were naked? And, well, they ate of the fruit. God interrogates them. What happens? Okay, well, the serpent, you know. Serpent beguiles Eve, and Adam's like, well, the woman you gave me. Okay? And so God proceeds to pass judgment. He passes judgment first on the serpent. The serpent's going to be cursed. The serpent is going to crawl on its belly. At this point now, the soil becomes cursed towards man. It's not that the creation is cursed in as much as the creation, the ground from which Adam was taken, now is going to prosecute man. It's going to bring forth thorns and thistles. All right? Instead of Adam and Eve having free eats, really, you know, this garden full of food, and engaging in scientific and aesthetic endeavors, and, you know, his work being purely pleasurable and enjoyable, now he's going to have to work by the sweat of his brow, because the earth's going to be cursed towards man. Okay? And now, you know, like in some cultures, you're just working to, you can't advance society, you can't advance culture, because you're just trying to put food on the table, subsistence living. All right? The ground's cursed. So what is the curse now? The curse is first placed on the serpent, particularly in reference to the soil. All right? Therefore, when you come to Leviticus 11 and you have all these clean and unclean animals, what we see, the common characteristic, and there's just a big list of animals, okay? The common characteristic seems to have to do with the way in which the animal comes in contact with the soil and its mode of locomotion. Okay? Particularly, you know, it has to do with, you know, sort of shoes that he has, the kind of hooves that he has. There's more to it than that. There's also what the animal eats. Okay? So animals that particularly don't have the proper kind of shoes, they don't have cloven hooves, etc., that come in contact with the cursed soil, they are unclean. Doesn't mean they're unhealthy or anything. It's just that they're coming in contact now with the cursed soil. You know, throughout the Old Testament, you know, you wear shoes unless you're in the presence of God, and then you take them off because you're on holy ground then. And then if a city doesn't listen to the gospel, then you shake the dust off your feet. All right? The ground is now cursed towards man. So those animals that particularly have some, you know, that they seem to be, you know, come in contact with the soil more, seem to be the ones that are unclean. When it comes to fish, the fish that have scales and fins and seem to move in a purposeful way, those are the ones that are clean, and the ones that don't have scales, you know, don't have like armor, so to speak, are the ones that are unclean. And remember the association with the Gentiles all throughout the Bible and the sea. Okay? The Gentiles are often depicted as coming up out of the sea, and you know, the outside of the land is, you know, that's where the Gentiles are. We talked about that when we studied Jonah. Same thing. The clean birds seem to, and insects are the ones that kind of hop from place to place when they light on things. So their contact with the soil is lessened. Or they're not scavenger birds. The scavenger birds that are eating the flesh, etc., are the ones that are unclean. It seems to have to do with death and the soil and the curse. That seems to be the distinction. And what this is all about, as it becomes very clear when we come to the New Testament, is it's trying to reinforce to Israel their need to be separate from the nations. In 1 Corinthians 6, Paul's going to talk about how, you know, the Corinthians should not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And he makes it clear that the laws against yoking a clean animal and an unclean animal together ultimately has to do with people. And that's very clearly seen in Acts chapter 10 and 11. In Acts chapter 10, Peter has this vision. This sheet comes down with all these unclean animals, and God tells him to eat. And Peter's like, I have never eaten any unclean animals. You know, he's a good, devout Jew. And God says, don't be called unclean what I have rendered clean. And so in the very next episode now, Peter is called to go to the Gentiles, to take the gospel to the Gentiles. It was very significant that Peter did that first, because Peter was the apostle to the Jews. Now, Paul gets into all sorts of trouble for going to the Gentiles, but you could always look back and say, hey, Peter, the apostle to the Jews, went there really in mass first. He goes, he preaches to Gentiles. Gentiles are converted. They receive the Spirit. They begin speaking in tongues. And in the very next chapter, he explains his rationale for going to the Gentiles by appealing to the vision he had. So it becomes very clear, here's what it is. Clean animals represent Israelites. Unclean animals represent Gentiles. Sacrificial animals, which were a subset of the clean animals, represent the priests. Okay? Unclean animals, Gentiles. Clean animals, Israel. And sacrificial animals, the priesthood. What God is doing is this. He's reinforcing at every meal Israel's need to be separate from the nations. And it becomes real clear in Leviticus 18, we'll see later, God says, so you shall distinguish between the clean and unclean so that you won't learn the ways of the nations. Okay? In the Bible, eating is, you know, I mean, look, what you open up the Bible and what do? You encounter man and he's hungry. Man, food. Okay? Okay, here's man. You're in a garden. Food. Eat from all these trees. Don't eat from that one. Eating, there's depths to eating that we haven't even begun to deal with. But Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, you either eat at the table of demons or you eat at the Lord's table. It's one or the other. And so whatever we do, whether we eat or drink, we're supposed to do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, right? Well, Paul could say that because he understood Leviticus. That's what this seems to be about. Okay? He's reinforcing in every meal who Israel's in covenant with. Okay? Israel's clean. The Gentile nations outside are unclean. And Israel is not to adopt the ways of the Gentiles in their lives. Kind of sort of makes sense, maybe. So, yes, sir.
Let's go back.
Connections there. You know, the fact that man returns to the dust, and we're going to see that there's kind of like leprosy is going to have to do with that. There are all sorts of things. You think about Jesus on the cross or going to the cross and everything. What does he do in the garden? He sweats like great drops of blood. Okay? He's taking on the curse. He gets his crown of thorns. What is the ground right for? Thorns and thistles. Jesus is naked on the cross. He's experiencing the curse. It's all connected, you know, just layer after layer. The ground is cursed towards man, and it brings forth thorns and thistles, and it all spread, you know. Adam's sin had consequences. And that's why I always say salvation is not just about going to heaven when you die. It's about turning back the curse. It's about pesticides and whatever. I mean, it's farming, agriculture. It's all of that. No more let sin and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found, as we always sing Joy to the World every year. Turning back the curse, salvation is. Yeah.
See, prior to the curse, Adam was made from the dust. Mm-hmm. So the dust was good prior to the
curse. It was. And Adam is, the first man, Paul says, is from the dust from the ground. The second is from above. And what Adam needed was to be born again from above, so to speak. And that's another discussion. Okay, we'll get into when we talk about baptism. Yeah.
All right, in Jesus' dialogue, Nicodemus, he was talking about if born of the flesh, born of the spirit. Mm-hmm. And he says to Nicodemus, are you not a teacher of Israel? Don't you know these things?
He should have known this a little bit. He should have understood all of this.
Exactly. Exactly. You got to be born again in the water of the Spirit. We're going to see. I'm going to show all. Whenever Israel's cleansed, it's by baptism, and it's by sprinkling. Okay, and later on in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul's talking about the resurrection, and he says, if there is no resurrection, then why do they baptize for the dead? Now, what is that baptism from the dead? The Mormons, they baptize their dead. Well, no. They are the Jews. Why do they baptize for the dead? If you're unclean, you're dead. You're ceremonially dead. You don't have access to God. So you got to be cleansed. You got to be sprinkled. If you understand Leviticus, all the debates about immersion and sprinkling, they're gone. They're history. I'll prove that later. I know that's a big claim. I guarantee you, I'll prove it. Yeah.
John the Baptist is baptized and he comes on the scene, and we're kind of like, a lot of times people think baptism is some sort of new ritual that's come up. No, they've been doing it since Moses' time. All these purifications in Leviticus are baptisms, and John is a priest. So I'd have to think about some other examples of that. But that's why Christian baptism is done by someone else. Circumcision was a sign of the priesthood more so than the sign of salvation. That's why there are plenty of uncircumcised Gentile believers in the Old Covenant. I'm getting a little ahead of myself right now. I know I'm making some claims and you might think I'm crazy. I'll make a case. All right, let's just get back to here. So Leviticus 11 is about clean and unclean animals. When you come to Leviticus 12, and it's all about uncleanness of a woman after childbirth. Okay? You give birth to a baby boy, unclean 40 days, baby girl, unclean 80 days, which just goes to show, right? Okay? What does that say? You know, all that snails and whales and puppy dog tails and, you know, sugar and spice. No, that's complete. No, I'm kidding. Okay. Why the difference? I don't know exactly, but for some reason, circumcision of the boy seems to shorten the uncleanness. Okay? That seems to shorten the uncleanness. And so I don't understand that exactly. It is a removal of the flesh. Flesh is associated with uncleanness. But it's the uncleanness. There's nothing wrong with childbirth, obviously. But the uncleanness comes from the flow of blood. There is a loss of life liquid, particularly from the private parts. Okay? So again, cutting your arm and bleeding would not render you unclean. Blood flowing from the private parts renders the woman unclean. The thing I want us to see is, this links back to Genesis 3 then. So God pronounces judgment on the serpent, especially in regard to his locomotion. Then he turns to Eve and pronounces judgment on her
particularly in regard to childbirth. Okay? She's going to, you know, bring, you know, pain in childbirth. All right? The judgment is pronounced against man, particularly upon the ground which from which the man was taken. And I'll just read number 3 here. It says, because man was made of the earth, the curse on the ground put man under the judgment of the ground. In particular, man would labor by the sweat of his brow until he eventually returned to the dust. Okay? As a result, Leviticus 13 is about leprosy. And leprosy is associated, it seems, especially with the sweat of the brow. We know this. The high priest, when he went into the most holy place, had to take off his garments of glory and beauty. He has to put on linen garments. And think about how many times linen garments come up in Scripture, okay? He has to put on linen garments. And Ezekiel gives us the rationale for it. He says, you know, you got to wear linen garments. Nothing that produces sweat. Because you can't sweat in the divine presence, because that's cursed. Okay? And so the high priest has to wear, you know, he has to put on linen garments, and he wears this hat, and on his forehead, specifically, and you read that in Exodus 28, all this emphasis is put on his forehead, it says, holy to the Lord. Now later on, in 2 Chronicles 26, King Uzziah usurps his authority. He goes into the tabernacle to offer up incense against the law, against the advice of the priest. And God strikes him with leprosy on his forehead. Of course, when Jesus is laid in the tomb, he's wrapped in linen garments. And so when the disciples come to the tomb, they notice the linen garments. There's the garments in which his body was laid. And then there's, most of your Bibles say handkerchief or something like that. But it was actually the band that wrapped up his head. And so particular attention is drawn to the fact that Jesus wore linen garments and he had, you know, something on his head. And of course, Jesus, as I mentioned in the garden, you know, sweat like great drops of blood. Okay. And so what you hear in Leviticus 13 then is laws concerning leprosy. And it talks in general about leprosy in the body, again, which is like this white flakiness, which the skin kind of dries up and becomes like dust. But then it especially focuses in on leprosy on the forehead, on the brow and the head. All right? Or I should say, and then leprosies for the body and head, again, are explained in order. All right? The connection between leprosy and death is very clearly seen in Numbers 12 when God strikes Miriam with leprosy. Aaron pleads with the Lord and says, please do not let her be as one dead whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb. Okay? So there's a clear connection there between her flesh and death. Okay? So, you know, leprosy has to do with this, with sweat, with the curse in the brow, that man's going to work until man returns to the dust. And I'll just read this next to last paragraph on the second page. It says, we see the connection between leprosy and the realm of death when Miriam became leprous and Aaron prayed, please do not let her be as one dead whose flesh is half consumed. Jordan says, in each case, the skin dried up and became flaky and white, like dust, the curse prosecuting dust of death. Thus, the plague of death was a kind of dusty sweat, a fitting image of the judgment upon man. Okay? And that's why it is particularly focused on the forehead. Makes sense to me. Anyway, there's a lot more. I don't get it all. I don't understand it all. But there clearly seems to be some connection there. All right. After that, okay, after the Lord pronounces these judgments on Adam and Eve, he begins to restore them through a series of promises and actions. Okay? One, he replaces their fig leaves with animal skins. It becomes very clear, had Adam and Eve not eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, They would have got garments of glory and beauty. Sometimes people think, well, Adam and Eve, you know, if it weren't for the fall, we wouldn't have clothes. No, Adam and Eve were naked. They were husband and wife, okay? They would have had clothes later. God would have, throughout Scripture, when you're enthroned, then you receive robe. You receive garments of glory and beauty. And I think that Adam and Eve, you know, had they done what they were supposed to have done, they would have been enthroned. They would have been allowed to eat the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They would have received garments of glory and beauty. They would have been made of vegetable rather than animal skins. Okay. So you got new garments now. And then Adam and Eve are cast out of the Garden of Eden, in this case for their good, so that they cannot eat of the tree of life. If they would have eaten the tree of life in that condition, they would have been sealed in that sinful state forever. So they're cast out of the Garden of Eden. And finally, a promise is made in regard the promise is already made in regard to the promised seed who was going to crush the head of the serpent. But the next thing we read about is Adam knew his wife Eve, and they have a son. Which at that point in time, you don't know if that's the promised seed or not. You know, how do you know? As you continue on through Levitical legislation, what we have after talking about leprosy on people is leprous garments. Okay? And there's ways to inspect the garments and for discoloration and so forth. Because those leprous garments got to be removed just like the fig leaves got to be removed. Okay? And the Bible picks up this analogy a lot of times when it talks about baptism. You know? And how, you know, we put on Christ in baptism. And Jesus tells these parables about the, you know, person who comes to the wedding feast and he doesn't have the right kind of garment on. Okay? And that's got to be replaced. Zechariah talks about the priest and how he's got these filthy garments on. And these filthy garments, they got to be replaced. Well, it's all rooted in this legislation. Okay? So in Leviticus, as Leviticus continues, you have the legislation for leprous garments. Then you have legislation for leprous houses. Leprosy can spread to houses. And so, you know, it can be in the plaster of the walls. You can come and the priest will inspect it. And if it's leprous, then you have to remove these stones and he has to cleanse the house. If the leprosy returns the second time and he cleanses and it still doesn't work, then the house has to be torn down, its timber and its stones. Okay? That's the legislation. Now, I've mentioned before, and we're over here on the third page, it's very significant that Jesus cleanses the temple twice. Okay? The word that is used in regard to what Jesus' action in the temple is the same one used for the cleansing of lepers. Remember, Jesus heals the lame, he heals the blind, but he cleanses lepers. And he also cleanses the temple. In John chapter 2, we read about Jesus doing that early in his ministry. And then later on in Matthew 24 and Mark 13, etc., we read about Jesus cleansing the temple the second time when he walks out and says, not one stone here is going to be left on another. He cleansed the temple the first time and, you know, he drives the demons out, so to speak. And what do? They come back with more. And so Jesus cleanses the temple the second time. And now it's leprous. It's got to be destroyed. So it is, of course, in AD 70. And I think the Jews or the disciples particularly would have picked up immediately on the fact when he says, not one stone here is left on another. They understood, you know, Jesus is saying this place is unclean. Okay? It's got to be destroyed. Finally. So Adam and Eve are driven out of their home, right? Okay, and so now we have leprous houses. Finally, Adam knows his wife Eve, she conceived. When God takes up his midst, takes up his presence in the midst of Israel, the act of intercourse becomes something that renders a person unclean. Okay? Let me just read this number three here. It says, now Genesis 4:1 says, now Adam knew his wife Eve and she conceived. According to Leviticus 15, this act rendered the two ceremonially unclean because any emission of a sexual or bloody nature from the private parts was defined as unclean. This is why man's sense of shame is focused on his private parts and explains why Adam and Eve sought to cover them with fig leaves. As a result, from the time of Moses onward, the act of marriage always resulted in temporary ceremonial uncleanness. Okay? Salvation is ultimately going to come from the promised seed, right? The seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the serpent. So Paul can say later on that the woman is saved through literally the childbirth. It's not women having childbirth. The Bible doesn't teach work salvation, but it's the childbirth. It's the birth of the promised seed. Okay? It's not the seed of the man. It's the seed of the woman that's going to crush the head of the serpent. However, man will not be able to bring that about through the flesh. That's why the three wives of the patriarchs are all barren. Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel. They're all barren. Or is it Sarah, Rachel, Rebecca? Whatever. They're all barren. And a miracle child has to be produced. The three wives of the lifelong Nazarites are barren. Okay? Samson's mom. Hannah, the mother of Samuel, and then Elizabeth, John the Baptist's mother. Curiously, in the Song of Hannah, Hannah says the barren has borne seven. Well, before Jesus, you got the three wives of the patriarchs and the three moms of the lifelong Nazarites. A miracle child is delivered on the other side of the barrenness. All that's looking forward to the virgin birth, which is the seventh, okay, the ultimate barren womb, the womb of the virgin. God's going to have to produce you see, man, even in his childbearing, even in the act of intercourse, it renders what he produces unclean. That's what, because we're dead in trespasses and sin. And so we need God to bring forth the promised seed. Okay? Next, the last paragraph in quotes says, what seems to be particular about the issues of Leviticus 15 is that they all come from the privates. And thus from the innermost parts of the person. Since it is here that man's rotten dead heart is exposed, it was the privates that Adam and Eve sought to cover first. In other words, it is when the life of blood and seed come in contact with the inner defilement of a man that it renders him unclean. Again, it's got to do with life and death issues. Okay, semen and blood. Urination does not render you unclean. Semen and blood do. Okay? Michael Morales sums it all up like this. Since Israel's greatest blessing was the presence of God, being clean could be understood as admittance to Eden, while becoming unclean was a reenactment of the fall. As Adam and Eve experienced a living death when they were expelled from Eden, so every man who is diagnosed as unclean suffered a similar fate. Now again, without getting into the details, that makes a lot of sense to me. That makes, you know, you read Leviticus 11 to 15, there's all these strange, weird laws and rules, and they just seem so foreign to us. And yet, there's a clear rationale to what this is all about. And I think that the Israelites grasp this a lot more than we do. But when you understand some of these things, a whole lot of the things Paul talks about in Romans about the flesh, circumcision, and all these kind of topics that come up, they start to make a whole lot more sense than they otherwise would. Okay? And a lot of times I think we think we understand Romans and stuff. Everybody likes to preach through Romans, and yeah, we got a long ways to go.